You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
You are with Ken Vellante in the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast. And I'm very excited this week to have a guest, Rad Baluchian, who I encountered a new book he's written called Wax Pack, baseball book, about maybe a throwback activity, getting a pack of baseball cards and the random component of which player's in there. What's different is that Brad got a few of them, then picked one of those cards and set out to try to visit each of the players in that pack and find out after baseball what they were doing. This pack was from 1986, and we're going to talk about that book, and we're going to talk a little philosophy, a little bit of art, a little bit of Rhode Island. He's a Rhode Island native now on the West Coast, very much like myself. Brad Baluchian, want to invite you to Something Rather Than Nothing podcast. It's a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Ken.
Again, my pleasure. Brad, first question, what were you like as a young kid?
I was very quiet. I got picked on a lot. Like, my hardest years were middle school, junior high, an awkward stage. I was late to hit puberty and late to develop. So I had like a really squeaky voice and was really short and buck teeth and, you know, not exactly a ladies' man. And also, but I was also very studious. And so I kind of got shoved into the nerd camp, you know, pretty early on there. But I was also always someone that I think didn't follow the crowd. I sort of had my strong convictions and never wanted to feel that I was being pressured to do anything. I, you know, just sort of thought for myself, very independent in that way. I'm always been grateful that I knew exactly what I was interested in. I had my passions were very clear from a young age, and I loved baseball. I loved islands, which is something that ended up taking me all the way into my career. And, you know, I know it's kind of odd to have a favorite land form, but, but I did. I loved professional wrestling. So, you know, I had these very clear passions that I still consider my passions today.
Yeah, I love your response. It's always interesting when I talk to guests as far as, you know, what, how they, you know, viewed themselves as a young age. And, you know, sometimes it's like, somebody's a painter, you know, they're 3 years old and like kind of painting watercolors, you know, or, right. Yeah, and just then ended up just doing it later on. But you grew up in Rhode Island, which I did as well. And if I'm correct, you grew up in Greenville, Rhode Island, which is, how far is that from Providence?
It's about 12 miles northwest of Providence, up in the northern part of the state.
Yeah, so and during that time when you were younger, of course, you picked up the habit of collecting baseball cards. When did that happen, and how'd you get into that?
I wish I could remember the very first day I saw a baseball card, but I can't. But I do remember that my dad was a huge baseball fan and got me into following baseball and, you know, looking at the standings and the box scores. And then it must have been him. He brought home some cards. He collected them as a kid. Then brought me home, you know, a pack of cards and said, hey, you might like these. And that's all I needed to, you know, somehow the cards made it so much more tangible and real to me. And then, you know, I just became fascinated by the players and their stats and organizing the cards and trading them and all of that.
Yeah. And how did you, did it end up becoming a little bit of a habit, a little bit of an addiction? I mean, how do you support your addiction?
My allowance wasn't that big, but I was able to, you know, get cards here and there. And I always liked, in a way, it was convenient for my wallet, because my favorite players were the common cards, the kind of underdog guys whose cards were basically worthless. So I would be at my happiest buying a bunch of 3 cent common cards. You know, I wasn't out to get all the star players. And so it was a pretty affordable hobby.
Brad, I want to stop you right there. A good part of what I'd seen on your website and the way you talk about this. I want to pause right there. I found it so interesting, and you get this into the book of, I just kind of stumbled. My jaw dropped and, you had a favorite player, Don Carmen. I was like, I kind of, remember that name. But, you're very clear in talking about, the underdog. And it's definitely a great passion of mine. I work in a labor union. And when it came to baseball cards, though, I just wanted to tell you my strange thing with it. I like the big stars. I really did. I remember when I first started collecting, Dwight Gooden, right? Who, of course, shows up in, doesn't show up in, a chapter in your book. But I also like kind of the players that were personalities, even if they weren't that good, who did something kind of strange or were flamboyant or like kind of didn't follow the rules, kind of, I always found the baseball rules to be some of the traditions are okay and some of them are just like, I think these traditions need to be, broken or something. But you talk about, just being into regular, those common cards and you've kept that throughout. And what was it like for you talking about that when, some of your heroes or some of your favorite players were ones that were tough for others to remember?
Well, yeah, I never wanted the players to think that I was like making fun of them because I was genuinely, truly, sincerely interested in and fans of those guys. And, the reality is not those guys don't, that the underdog players don't have huge fan followings. But I think for me, it was always, and it's been a common theme in my life that I always will go and root for the group that is underprivileged or underdog or has less power. I've seen that play out in so many parts of my life. Like when I'm still adjunct faculty at a college here in Oakland, California, and the inequities and the disparities between how adjunct faculty are treated versus full-time faculty led me to become the rep for all the adjuncts in our union. So it's become a theme of mine that I feel very strongly about justice and about, helping those that are not in the position of power.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that and definitely connect to the work that you do, and also wanted to thank you, for your service and helping other workers. So before we fully blast into some of the baseball stuff, I just wanted to ask you, your process, your professor, and you have, other interests, but now you're going to be interviewed and identified as a writer. What writing is a particular art form. For you, what art forms do you enjoy? I mean, do you enjoy do you enjoy books? What are your favorite types of art?
Yeah, for me, so even though I didn't have a background in sports writing, I have actually been a writer for a long time. My first job out of college was working at Islands Magazine in Santa Barbara as a fact checker and an editor. And then I've freelanced over the years, worked for the LA Times science desk as a reporter for a summer. So I've always had this dual career of journalism and science. And this is the first time, this is my first book, and it's sort of outside my usual area because I usually write about science. But sure. My training and what I'm really passionate about is narrative nonfiction and creative nonfiction. And that's, it's harder and harder to do that because there are fewer outlets that publish it. So it's become very financially, not very viable financially. My favorite form of art is that creative nonfiction. And I was so happy to finally have a chance to do that in writing this book. And I think you know, creative nonfiction is just one form of storytelling. And I think storytelling is something that almost all of us can relate to or attracted to, whether it's in movies or books. Yeah, I mean, I love to read. I would say reading is my number one form of art consumption, maybe followed by TV and movies. And in terms of art, you know, to me, it's really fun to be able to have these vastly different careers, because in my biology professor world, which is science, it's science, very much left brain, objective analysis. And in the writing, it's very much the right brain, the creative part, the artistic part. And so I like being able to toggle back and forth between those two realms of art and science.
Yeah. And it's, it can be difficult. I see on the outside, you know, to try to define or explain, you know, who are you? I think in the book, great picture, Rick Sutcliffe, kind of rolled up and you're ready to interview him. And it's like, you know, what's your story, buddy? You know, like that type of thing. And sometimes it's tough to explain. I had interviewed recently Rachel Balkovic, who's the first female hitting coach in Major League Baseball history, working for the New York Yankees. You know, part of my looking at baseball was always, as I got older, I looked at it more as far as like the art of hitting, you know, according to Ted Williams and some famous Japanese players. And, you know, I also look at like at the art of pitching. But before we get into some of that stuff, what about the big question for you on art before we move on? What is art for you?
Well, I think art is just expression, and it is how humans express themselves and their creativity. It's a form of communication. It's personal. It's belief based. I think it's subjective. I'm actually not a good person to talk about visual arts. I mean, I'm woefully incompetent when it comes to anything sort of visual art, spatially. You know, my artistic talents are more limited to the writing world. But in terms of, I mean, I think that in the way that science is a way of understanding the world using objective evidence and the weight of objective evidence, art is unburdened by that expectation. And that's what makes art so freeing. And so art is emotional. It's emotion is sort of the foundation of art. Whereas there is no room for an emotion in science in terms of the actual data.
Yeah. And, one way I had in talking about this was with recently, I'm not sure why I'm referring to all these different episodes lately. I guess I've done enough episodes, but Dr. Erin McDonald was one of my guests, and she, you know, she's a scientist, PhD, space science. She explains, you know, dripping black holes and multiverse, but she's also a consultant creatively on science fiction shows. So it's very interesting to look at, as you try to navigate, you know, the technical, the techne of science, and with art, and trying to meld those two, is, you know, what areas are they overlapping? You can speak cohesively about them. And it sounds like with your work in trying to create things, you kind of navigate that terrain a lot.
Well, I think art and science are fundamentally different, but that doesn't mean that they can't coexist and work together, right? I think too often we get in trouble in science when we forget that we're all human. Scientists are humans doing science. So the science itself, you know, we strive to be objective, but ultimately, you know, we make mistakes, and we have our biases that seep into our work. And I think also with science does no good if it's not applied to society and has some, you know, science needs to inform policy in order to be meaningful and effective. And sometimes the application of science to policy and society requires more art, you know, in the form of how you communicate, and how you interact with people. Those are all the sort of, you know, the skills that make a great science communicator, which is very different from a great scientist. And from the art side, you know, you look at baseball, which I think is this sort of beautiful blend of art and science. Baseball has had a huge influx of science with analytics, and yet the game, if the game was just about analytics, it wouldn't have the power that it does. And so there's an importance of art in baseball as well.
Yeah, that's just a great point. Yeah, the rise in analytics and the science of it. The science and art right there. Well, let's get into the baseball. And I know you've been, the book came out, Waxback came out, I believe might have been right at the beginning of April, very recently, yeah, right? Sure. Last few weeks. Happy to see it's shown up. Is it on the LA Times nonfiction list, correct?
Yeah, I just found out this morning. I was super excited. I got an email and said, oh, you're on the bestseller list for the LA Times, which I had no idea. So I was very excited to see that. The story, I don't know if we'll get into this, but the story of the book getting published itself became an underdog story and dealing with all the rejection and all of that. So it's
Talk about that right now, Brad. Let's launch into the Wax Pack. Tell the story to Wax Pack. How did it come about?
Sure. Well, I mean, it started just as an idea in 2014 to write a book based on a pack of cards. And it's a pretty simple premise. You could write a lot of different books with that conceit. And I tinkered with different ideas, like, oh, maybe I'll write about what happened in the 86 season, told through the perspectives of the different players. And then I realized really I thought the best possible book would be one that was road trip based and that was about, well, what happens to these guys when they're done playing. And also it provided an opportunity for me to insert myself as a character in the narrative. And I think one thing I realized in doing this, in writing the book, was how I'm, I think, at my strongest as a writer when I'm a participant in the story. I'm not so interested in writing just straight memoir, but that sort of blend of memoir and reportage in a narrative nonfiction context is sort of my sweet spot. And so I had the idea, I got the pack, I did all the research and contacted the players. I mean, that whole part, while it was challenging, went off really well. The trip was fantastic in 2015. And because I'd had so much interest from agents to represent me, and when you're trying to get a nonfiction book deal, you basically need to have an agent if you want to get any kind of decent financial deal from the big publishing companies, of which there are basically five that control all the publishing in New York. They call them the Big Five. And so my agent, we went out with the project and then started getting rejected. And then that sort of started a couple of years of writing proposals and rewriting and changing agents and all in all getting rejected 38 times, which was really demoralizing. Because I never felt like the rejections were based on the quality of the work. I mean, they even said as much. They were like, well, it's a great idea and great writing, but you don't have 100,000 Twitter followers and, you know, no one knows
who,
and you don't have a platform. So we're not going to basically take a chance on you. And that's all I wanted was someone. I knew I was an unproven commodity and it would take a risk. But I really believed, you know, I think I'm self-aware enough to know when I have something that's good or not good. And, you know, I have plenty of stuff that's not good. But I just never stopped believing. I had this strong conviction that if I could just get a chance to write the book that was in my head, it would work. And finally, the University of Nebraska Press was willing to take a chance on me and signed a deal with me. But it was for very, very little money. I mean, they're a very small publisher. They can't afford to offer big book deals. So basically any chance of making this at all financially viable are based on, you know, selling copies now and royalties. So to see the book hit a bestseller list is feels like great vindication.
And that was Nebraska, that was University of Nebraska. So Brad, originally from Rhode Island, living out in Oakland, and University of Nebraska comes through.
Mm-hmm. That's you know, I've never heard it put that way, but that's a great, you know, here you got East Coast, West Coast, and the center.
Yeah, you got the call up from Nebraska, and that's it's good. I mean, it's fantastic that the book is out there, and you know, for listeners, I mean, I've read the book. It's a great book. It's a sweet spot for me. You know, 1986 baseball cards. You know, but you know, it's very clear, Brad, in the book about, you know, you say you're not doing straight memoir. But, you know, you're talking about, you know, your relationship to your heroes in there's a certain randomness within the pack, your relationship to, you know, friends, family, and your father. Did you feel that the book really, ended up being about, you know, all of that, or did you see, were you surprised as something developed that you were writing and be like, I didn't mean to write about this, but here we go.
Well, some of the themes came out as I met the players, like the father-son theme of, you know, how many guys had really bad relationships with their fathers. I didn't know that going in. So that became something. But I knew that I wanted to write a book that would go beyond baseball, that would be very personal, and that would ultimately, hopefully, engage the reader emotionally and in a way that they would resonate because the reader could relate to these sort of universal themes. I mean, I think everyone has made a mistake and has had their heart broken and has been in love and has experienced fear and rejection. And, you know, so the way, if I could use my story and the baseball player stories to get at those larger themes, I felt like that would allow the reader to emotionally invest in the whole narrative. And so I always had very, I mean, it's always very ambitious. I remember in the early stages when I was sort of going back and forth with the editors and the agents and the gatekeepers of publishing, they kept pushing me to make it more straight baseball. And I kept saying, it's not really a baseball book. I mean, I get it. It's really ambitious and risky because it's mixing travel and sports and memoir in this sort of unconventional way. And, you know, most sports related books are not like this.
Right.
I felt that was the void that I was trying to fill. And they may have thought there was no market for it, but I always believed that there was, because it's a book that taps into your emotion.
And it must have been quite, I don't want to speak for you, I mean, but quite the tension, as you said, it was difficult to have this, you know, book see light, and then you want to control, you know, what the darn book is. That must have taken some time in dealing with, you know, you want to get, it's that dilemma, you want to get the book out there, you want it to be true to you, but you also have to, you know, understand that you don't control all elements of it, right?
Well, I think, I mean, so when I was facing my 38th rejection, my agent at the time actually said to me, I think we've reached the end of the road here. And I said, I don't think so. And that's when I went off. I actually ended up not even having an agent with Nebraska. And to Nebraska's credit, they gave me the freedom and the space to write the book I wanted to write. And I don't know, at a bigger publisher, maybe that would have been more contentious, but I'm always grateful to my editor, Rob Taylor, and the people at Nebraska, because they said, okay, you know, we trust you, you go do it. And I'm glad that I was able to do that.
Okay. And then on the road trip portion of it, the book itself, you get into your Honda, right? Adjunct professor, you say, I'm going to start. So just, you know, for the listeners, without, you know, giving away, you know, all the elements of the book, I recommend the book to the listeners. Fantastic book. I actually downloaded it on a Nook, which I hadn't used for years. So it was nostalgic going
That's
back the, about
the Barnes and Noble thing.
Yeah. The Barnes and Noble Nook. So it was nostalgic for me going back to 2014. To download it on the Nook, and then nostalgic to travel back to 86. But you get in your Honda and you start your trip. So to the level you want to share, tell folks what you know, what happens? You get in your Honda, you start visiting the players. What happens?
Well, 11,341 miles of road in 7 weeks. It was basically, you know, I'd planned the itinerary in advance, but, you never know what's going to happen. So I started going down Central Valley of California, down to Southern California, and then just drove across with a bunch of zigzags. And I would get into a town and, you know, meet up with a player. And I would try to vary the environment in which I met the player for the narrative's sake. So, for example, Randy Reddy, we go bowling and go to the gym. And Rick Sutcliffe took me around his neighborhood where he grew up and his high school. And I watched Kung Fu movies with Gary Templeton. So it was fun to do a lot of different things with the players. And then when a few of the players that were more famous did not want to talk to me, those chapters are about the rogue and kind of unorthodox tactics that I use to try to find them. And those chapters are kind of entertaining, I think.
And for folks who might not be familiar with baseball cards, I believe in that year there would have been 15 cards, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many players did you end up visiting?
So there were, of the 15, one of those cards with a checklist. One of them had passed away. So for him, I went and met up with his cousin and his son. So that's 13. Of the 13, I got extensive time with 9 of them, briefly met another one. And so what, there were 3 that I never really got to meet.
I was, as I mentioned, I'm from Pawtucket, Rhode Island, with the Pawtucket Red Sox. Actually, I think I might say, I don't know if this is their last year. They're moving.
I think they're gone, yeah.
Yeah, they're moving to Worcester. They moved to Worcester. Big controversy from where I'm from. But Pawtucket Red Sox are the AAA, the highest level before you get to the major leagues. A famous family-friendly venue in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, where you actually, I think you ended up there for a bit in the boating journey.
Exactly.
Yeah. What were your impressions of McCoy Stadium in Pawtucket, Rhode Island?
Well, it's funny because I went to McCoy many times as a kid on class trips, and, you know, the Paw Sox were like just a fun, cheap night out. But when you're a kid, you don't see the world in the same way as you do with your adult eyes. And so coming back and seeing it in my mid-30s, I remember just being struck by how much of a time capsule it seemed to be, and that like it's you're in this very blue collar suburban neighborhood, and all of a sudden you hit a minor league baseball stadium. You know, it's not like it's surrounded by a lot of retail and, you know, and sort of a modern look.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that it's just this neighborhood ballpark, very sleepy, hasn't changed a lot. And so yeah, I went there to meet up with Richie Hebner, who was coaching a minor league team that was in town to play the Pawtucket Red Sox.
Yeah, and that's right. Of course, you had been to a few games. I had gone to a lot, and I mentioned in a separate, just a message to you, in 81, there was the longest baseball game in baseball history that my dad took us to. I think we were there to about the 11th of the 33 innings.
Yeah, I remember as a kid, we had they would give away the cup that you would get your soda in was.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
The 32 innings, and then they resumed the game another day, right?
Yeah. And let me tell you just a quick thing about, you know, McCoy Stadium. And I had my brother and I were really big into getting autographs, and access in Pawtucket was really good. So it was really a special thing. I don't know if you remember. I mean, sometimes you'd have a top-notch Major League Baseball player, you know, on a rehab assignment, or, you know, up-and-coming stars that it isn't like after the game ended that everybody was accessible, right? I mean, it's baseball. Right. Some guys are really big and, you know, they want to go to the bar, you know, like, or, right, you know, they want to get out after a long game. But a lot of players stuck around and spent the time. And for me, the baseball experience was, you know, prior to the game, getting a lot of autographs. Yeah. And then after the game was really a 5 to 6 hour trip. So you went quite a few times, and I'd imagine you had a nice experience going to Pawtucket, to the Pawtucket Red Sox games when you were younger, right?
Yeah, it's funny. In the book, I actually went and went before the game and saw a bunch of the fans getting autographs, and you know, that's a scene that I think is just part of the baseball experience.
Yeah. Well, one of the questions I have on baseball and. You know, you're an educated guy with a PhD, a lot of different interests. I've always found baseball to be, you know, just a top subject for me. And I have a lot of idiosyncratic, non-traditional views on baseball myself. One of the things I think baseball does in general, regardless, is to attract thinkers who think about the game. It seems to be a sport that brings in a lot of elements of culture, a lot of analysis, a lot of thinking. Why do you think baseball attracts, you know, thinkers like yourself?
Well, I think it's been around forever. I mean, it's the oldest sport of the major sports. And I think that it's really that it's slow. I mean, I think a lot of the reasons why people don't like it are the reasons why people that are, you know, maybe more literary or, you know, as you know, wanted sort of deep thinkers, they like baseball because it provides all this time to think and analyze and reflect. And I think baseball is the ideal sport for building relationships because of all that downtime. And there's also, you know, there's a lot of unseen strategy that serious fans are aware of. And, of course, it's a very quantitative game in terms of all the statistics and the analysis. And so people get really into that. I mean, I'm not as interested in the granular details of all that. But I think the sports... again, it's sort of languorous pace is very conducive to a literary feel to it.
It's something to do between innings almost, right?
Even between pitches, I mean, yeah.
Between pitches, right? There's a component, you know, in the book that struck me as a big theme. And I think it fits into a kind of popular baseball stereotype, right? The guy on the road, right? The stress on the family. And I had the weird anecdotes, you know, like around the when I was talking about, you know, the autographs, getting the autographs after the game, it sounds, you know, like, you know, quaint and nice, and it really is. But there was also the John after the game with prostitutes with him for the players. It was very clear, like in there's this you know, it's kind of like the underbelly of, you know, Pawtucket that was readily apparent where I grew up. But you talk about relationships in the book, and you talk about, you know, guys on the road. I think they would say you're on the road, so even after they might have retired, they would be on the road, they'd be moving up through the coaching ranks in single A or double A. I mean, that become a huge piece of, as far as the tension on family, the stress on family, or what family is. That seemed to be a huge theme that just really emerged from your book.
Yeah, no, I think that's, you know, I think that's exactly right. I mean, the road trip motif, I think, works really well for the book because of the fact that baseball is this game that's so associated with all the travel and being on the road, and, you know, it just brings up all these stresses and challenges that are very, very difficult to deal with.
So right now, one of the questions I have, you know, given the radical changes in the world with the coronavirus, and there's a lot of discussion around, you know, what is the role of you know, art or books or sports in a pandemic. You know, a lot of baseball fans are waiting for baseball, but of course it has to be safe on a level, you know, that we would understand. What do you find the role right now for, you know, say, you know, sports right now, you know, in a pandemic, as far as what people need and what we can expect?
Yeah, I think I personally am not a big fan of rushing any of these sports back, including baseball. I would be fine if there was no season this year. And I miss the game a lot. I do think that baseball is this salve and this, you know, this very healing thing in our lives. But the idea of, you know, bringing the game back when clearly we don't really have a handle on the epidemic, the pandemic, and, you know, the testing really isn't there yet. And so, you know, I don't feel good about them trying to rush back just to assuage people's stress. Not to mention that, like, the ideas of having no fans and having, like, these, you know, not the traditional leagues. I just think it's unnecessary. And I think it's the owners really just wanting to save some money. You know, they're going to lose their shirt just like everyone else is losing their shirt right now. So while I recognize the vital importance of sports in our society, I don't really advocate rushing them back.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk just Oakland for a second. Oakland Coliseum, has a bad rap, had a bad rap before I went to it. I love the Oakland Coliseum for very particular reasons for me, including the price to get really nice seats.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I love the Oakland Coliseum. I've been a few times when I moved to the West Coast, I started going. I'm like, I like this place. What are your impressions of the Oakland Coliseum?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I talk about it in the book, same reasons you do. And I mean, to me, a baseball field is a baseball field. I mean, yeah, it's nice. I mean, you know, again, maybe if you're going with a family and you want entertainment, but to me, the entertainment is on the field. So I'm fine with it being kind of a dump. And as you say, you can go really cheap. I mean, last year I had the A's access and you get tickets to all 81 games for $280. You know, it's incredible.
Whoa.
Yeah. And half off on all your concessions. So it's a great deal. And I would actually go up in the nosebleeds and have like a whole section to myself and really enjoy it. Because, I mean, for me, it's also like I'm happy going to a game by myself. It's very meditative for me. I also like going with people, but it's an entirely different experience when I go with other people.
We share a peculiar habit when it comes to movies and baseball games. I like the solitude. So that's great. And you can find some big spots. You know, I think maybe when Tampa Bay is playing in Oakland, you can have some wide stretches of real estate over there at the Coliseum sometimes.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So one of the questions I have is a little bit bigger question, related to your, you know, creative process, but, you know, you're a writer, researcher. You ever step back and say, in particular with this book, why am I doing this? Why do you create?
Well, I think for me, it's curiosity. It's like, you know, inveterate curiosity that's just inside of me. And I have this passion for learning and for finding things out, that fulfills me. It's that process of learning and answering questions, brings me happiness. I really enjoy that process. You know, I think where I like then sharing that with other people and hope that other people relate to whatever it is that I create. But it's really coming from, you know, this sort of whatever it is that I happen to be passionate about, wanting to there's the element of wanting to find out, but then also wanting to share it in a way that is artistic and that resonates with other people. And I think ultimately I'm driven in my writing career more by, and even in my scientific career, more by sort of knowledge for the sake of knowledge than anything that's overly applied. You know, in my scientific research, there are scientists that are out there trying to solve big problems, whether it's, you know, pandemics or climate change, and you know, all these things are vitally important. But I've always been honest about the fact that my interests are not so much applied in that way as they are creating new knowledge and understanding the world for the sake of it, which is a very kind of abstract, you know, kind of touchy-feely motivation. But I think it's also necessary. It's part of our human condition to want to learn and understand and be curious. And I think it's still vitally important, even if it's not, you know, solving these direct problems.
Yeah. I got two or three more pitches for you, Brad. Okay. I'm not going to tell you what they are. You have to be ready at the plate. Okay. Grew up in Rhode Island. You remember Rocky Point?
Sure. Yeah. I remember the commercial. I still can think of the jingle in my head of the commercial.
Rocky Point. It's so exciting. I'm going to have a guest coming up who's going to talk about the next couple of weeks, the urban legends of Rocky Point. One of the things I didn't know is that it actually started or was built in 1846 or something outrageous like that. Yeah. Wow. Like the oldest. It closed in the 90s, but, it definitely made me realize why there are so many urban legends and haunted stories about Rocky Point. It's an institution for Rhode Islanders. So here's the slider coming at you. Why is there something rather than nothing?
Why is there something rather than nothing? Yeah, now we're getting into some real, you know, philosophical stuff here. How do we know that there isn't nothing? I don't know. I mean,
I don't know.
To me, it's an unanswerable question, and maybe that's the point, right?
That is, I tell you, I've been waiting for that answer for a while. It's mm-hmm. one of the identified unanswerable questions in some traditions. Mm-hmm. One of the things, just to drop back into what you were saying, when you're talking about some of the, you know, players that are your heroes or you're really interested in that were the common cards. I remember a quote, and I'm paraphrasing, was from a pitcher who pitched for the Red Sox for a little while. He also pitched for the Baltimore Orioles for a while, Mike Boddicker.
Oh, yeah.
And when Mike Boddicker pitched for the Red Sox, he went on a stretch. I don't know when the heck it was, but he went on a stretch where he was unhittable. You know, when pitchers, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine games or a season, like Doc Gooden, where you just can't hit him. And they were talking to him. He threw a lot of junk balls. You know, he threw every type of pitch imaginable. And they said, what's going on? I mean, you just seem to be in some sort of zone. And he says, I knew I was in the zone during this streak because during one of the games towards the late innings, I was making up pitches. Yeah. He was so into it. He was putting his hand on the ball in a different way, and it still worked for him.
Ultimate confidence there.
Mike Boddicker. I'll never forget that. The why is there something rather than nothing may be an unanswerable question. Brad Baluchian here. Brad, can you, in wrapping up here, can you tell folks, you're interested in a lot of stuff, but tell them how to connect with you, with the book, with your, you know, attempts to, you know, popularize science, you know, your science writings, you know, all that other stuff that you do. Can you point listeners in the right direction to connect with the work you do?
Yeah, sure. I think the easiest place is to go to waxpackbook.com, and from there you can link out to my personal websites and read more about my projects. I'm also on Twitter at WaxPackBook, and I'm pretty active there. So yeah, I love to hear from readers and answer questions. And, you know, it's one of the more rewarding things now that the book is done is to be able to actually hear people's feedback. So I encourage people to get in touch.
Yeah, Brad, I want to say, as you know, as I told you before, is really excited to have you a guest on the show. And, you know, when you put something out there, like you have a book that is, you know, personal and about, you know, a topic that people enjoy and, you know, has nostalgic elements, there's a lot of power to those words. And, you know, just for you as an author, I mean, just to pause and say, it's a great experience to read about some of the common elements of, you know, the human experience and, you know, about life and family that's in the book. But also just to be talking about, you know, things that you forgot, baseball players that you forgot, anecdotes that you forgot. And I think your book, you know, kind of pulls all these pieces together. So it's really a significant work for me. And I just wanted to, you know, sincerely and directly thank you for, you know, your journey. And I think, you know, 5-6 years for you to, you know, get it out there. 38 rejections. I tell you, brother, I don't know how to, you know, I try my best with meditating, but I don't know how to handle, you know, 4 or 5 rejections. 38's a lot. So I appreciate your perseverance in putting this out and really applaud you and you know, showing up on the New York Times, you know, nonfiction list. Wish you a lot of success with this book. It's great work you're doing, brother.
Well, thank you. You know, and I appreciate that. You know, I've done a lot of interviews, but a lot of them ask the same questions over and over. So I really appreciated you coming, you know, having some really original questions and thinking more broadly about, you know, art and beyond just the scope of the book and what it's about. So it's always fun to have a conversation about these bigger things.
Thanks again, Brad. Great luck and fortune in your efforts. And, you know, as we hope and cross our fingers and pray or whatever anybody wants to do about things, you know, coming back to normal with travel or when safeguards are in place, I hope, you know, that the whatever the equivalent of, you know, the road trip and what you could do in the future, you know, comes about for you. But again, deep thanks, Brad Baluchian, author of The Wax Pack. Thank you for stopping by Something Rather Than Nothing, and really appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Take care, brother. Thank you.
All right. You too.
You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing.